Hey, it's your pal Mike Shea of SlyFlourish.com, Twitter.com/SlyFlourish, and guest contributor for the Emmy Award-winning website CriticalHits.com. Tonight I had the great pleasure to speak to Michael Mallon. Michael is the writer of the website The Id DM, a longtime dungeon master, and a practicing psychologist. On his website, Michael uses this combination to discuss the psychology of the gaming table and perform the best data-driven analysis of 4th edition combat I've seen. Tonight, Michael and I discuss the role of a dungeon master, his analysis of the Penny Arcade Live Play podcasts, Power Creep in 4th edition, and the paradox of choice. This podcast is 1 hour and 10 minutes long, and I hope you enjoy it. So, I'd like you to talk about one particular patient by name, if you would.
Yes. That won't get me into trouble at all.
What? Oh. that was a test. See?
Is this being recorded?
I'm tricky. Like that.
If it's not being recorded, I'll just go right ahead. It's not a breach of confidentiality if it's just one person. That's
right.
What I've been told.
Excellent, excellent. So we'll go ahead and get started. I always like to, you know, one of the things that I always enjoy in things that I read and in podcasts that I listen to is when people get right into the meat of the topic and offer up some good practical advice that people can use right away. So, based on your experience, both as a psychologist and as a dungeon master, and then kind of blending those two disciplines together, what are the three biggest pieces of advice that you have for dungeon masters in running their games?
Great question. Well, I think the first thing
that a great question. You think I'm just messing around here, or
I have to, you know, provide you some positive reinforcement to start off.
Thank
with.
You. I actually could use the positive reinforcement. I appreciate
that. And speaking of that, I think one of the main things to be aware of as a DM and as a player, but certainly as a DM, is just an awareness of communication issues that are going on at the table between yourself as the DM and the players. And I think that communication exists both in the session around the table and also outside the session between telephone calls and emails or other ways that you might communicate with your players, such as Twitter or, you know, Google Plus and some other avenues. And I think one thing to be aware of is not just the verbal communication that happens at the table, who's talking, how much are people talking, but also the nonverbal communication that's going on at the table, which I find is often much more informative. Paying attention to the players that are perhaps checked out, you know, who's on their cell phone, who's fidgeting around, who's rolling dice and looks kind of bored, mm-hmm. who's really sitting on the edge of their seat and engaged. These are a lot of the things I think you can pay attention to and try to link them to what's going on in the game. So if you created this really elaborate combat situation and five of the players are into it and one person seems to be completely pulled back from the table, it's probably a good indication that that person is just not into combat.
Mm-hmm.
And vice versa, if you have a really detailed NPC or location and plot line you're trying to work out through some role playing and other situational things around the table, and half the group is really interested and they're, you know, collaborating with each other and coming up with ideas, you know, that's excellent. But there might be a couple of other people who are, they're taking a break to use the bathroom, or they're going outside to have a cigarette, or they're doing something that shows they're not engaged.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's certainly something to pay attention to.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, related to that, I think as a DM, we can certainly, you know, model behaviors at the table that we would like to see.
Sure.
You know, returning to the combat situation, there's been a lot of talk about the speed of combat, or perhaps more specifically, the lack thereof.
People have been talking about that? I haven't really heard.
You know, it's rumors,
okay.
Hearsay.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you're DM and you want fast combat, you have to take your turns quickly for the monsters. I think you have to model the type of behavior you want for your players. So if you want your players to speed up and you want them to take quick turns and be decisive and move things along, they're not going to do that if when it comes your time to take monster actions, you're plodding around and, you know, looking at your stat blocks back and forth and weighing options about what monster is going to do which. You know, if you take a long time, the players are going to match that behavior and they're going to take a long time.
Right.
So I think you know, that's something that DMs need to be aware of, is they're modeling the type of game the players are gonna gravitate towards.
Mm-hmm.
If the DM isn't really emphasizing, you know, exploration or communication with NPCs or investigation in the world, the players probably aren't going to focus on those things because it doesn't seem like the DM thinks it's important.
Right. Interesting. And what's your third?
Well, somewhat related to that is, you know, as a DM, in terms of modeling behavior, you want to certainly reward your players for things that you want them to do. One thing I tend to do is I have +1 tokens, which are actually poker chips,
mm-hmm.
and I give those out when my players do something cool,
mm-hmm.
for lack of a better word.
Mm-hmm.
So if my player does something that's unique, if they actually role play a power that they have,
mm-hmm.
I enjoy that. So it's not just like, hey, I use Stunning Strike, okay, here's my roll. You know, if they really describe what they're doing, I reward that. Or if they come up with a really creative or cool solution to a challenge that's posed in the game, I'll give them a +1 chip that they can use on any future roll.
Right.
Because most of my group really enjoys the combat component.
Sure.
And the story, in some degrees, becomes a little secondary at times to some of the players. But those guys have become a little bit more engaged on the storytelling side because they know they'll be rewarded for it, which they can use in combat.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been a nice way to kind of enhance some of the plot lines by using that. And it kind of tails into the third point of, just as a DM, be willing to examine your belly button, so to speak. You know, really be open to feedback,
mm-hmm.
from your players. Be willing to examine yourself as a DM, and, you know, this sounds kind of silly, but also as a person. I've said that, you know, when you strip away all the rules and mechanics, it's you and a bunch of your friends sitting around at a table talking to one another,
right.
and communicating. So if you're not comfortable with that, or you're not really aware of all the different levels of communication going on,
right.
I think that can become an issue. So just be willing to accept feedback, be honest with players, and talk to them, find out what they want.
Right, right. It's interesting on your first point. It's something, and I've seen this come across on Twitter, and it's certainly been in, I think it was in the, there was an article recently, I'll have to say, I think it was Dungeons Master, where they were going back and looking at top articles of theirs, and one of their articles was like the 7 worst things they've seen at a D&D table, and one of them was, you know, heavy use of like cell phones and stuff like that. And you know, it's interesting because I'm of two minds on it as a player. You know, I think like everybody who uses the internet regularly, I now am, you know, I now suffer from ADD. And so I now hand my iPhone over to my wife when I sit down to play D&D. Because okay. as much as I'm interested in the game, I'm going to end up surfing Twitter. You know, I can't help myself. But on the side of the Dungeon Master, when I see people using their devices, like at first I would be like, you know, I'm going to put out a big bowl and they all have to put their various devices in the bowl. But on the other side, it's like, well, you know, it's after work and we're all tired and we want to relax. And if their way of relaxing is to roll dice when it's their turn and to, you know, hang out on their BlackBerry when it's not their turn, then who am I to tell them what they ought to be doing during their time? So I think different people have a different perspective of looking at that. But it's very interesting to kind of look at it analytically and say, okay, well, why, you know, what's really going on? What's not drawing them in? What's, you know, how do I draw them back in? You know, I use things like off turn skill checks as something I use all the time.
Yeah, it's a great idea.
To try to get people involved, and you can do it while someone else is working out the math for their damage.
Yeah. And I'd like to be clear that I'm certainly not advocating people to become, you know, amateur psychologists and trying to analyze all their friends and
mm-hmm.
piece apart every little non-gesture or non-verbal gesture that's going on. But just to be aware of it,
sure.
and to talk to the group. And like you said, I think having that open communication, like asking the group, are you guys okay if we're each on cell phones, surfing Twitter or doing whatever
right.
in between turns, or do you find a distraction? And I think even in my group, that's a little bit mixed. I
mm-hmm.
can see some players when another person's checking email or doing something on their phone when it's not their turn, or they're not heavily engaged in the story at the moment.
Right.
I think some players get a little irritated with that. Others don't care. And I think each group's a little bit different. And certainly my group, the composition has changed over time as some players have, you know, exited the group because they had to go away to graduate school and new players come in. The dynamics shift around. So certainly just get to know your group, and be willing to adapt to, you know, their needs.
So you have a number of articles on your website that have always grabbed my attention since you started writing for it. And we're going to talk about a few of them today. One of them was one you just wrote on the 15th, entitled "I Am the Entertainer and I Know Just Where I Stand." And yes. your core hypotheses in that, in an article, the first line of the article is the players are at the table to win. The DM is at the table to entertain. Can you talk a little bit about that hypothesis and how you end up seeing that manifest at the table? What does that, you know, what does that mean for both players and dungeon masters? How does that balance play out?
Certainly. And I have to give a nod to Billy Joel for the lyric that provided the title for the post.
I didn't know he was a DM. Is it?
Yes. Basically what I think I posted it on Twitter several weeks ago to one of the conversations that was going on, and kind of as a response to somebody else, I wrote, the players are at the table to win, the DM is at the table to entertain. And there was some response to that back and forth. And then as I thought about it, I decided to write a longer post.
Sure, yeah. Needs more than 140 characters.
Yeah. If you've read some of my posts, you'll see that 140 characters really doesn't suit my style.
We'll just do a little word count here since I happen to be here. Go ahead.
I think that one's actually a little shorter than some of my other ones. But anyway, and more or less, you know, I've had the benefit of playing in two ongoing fourth edition groups for about 2 years now. One of the games, I'm the DM, and then on the alternate weeks, I'm the player. So I'm DMing about once every 2 weeks, being a player about once every 2 weeks. And just the disparity in time I devote to the game I DM compared to the game I'm a player in away from the table, it's just a night and day. As the DM for my campaign, when I'm not there at the table running the campaign, I'm usually asking for advice on Twitter about campaign ideas, asking about you know, monster creation, tweaking different storylines, creating NPCs, trying to think of how I'm going to get engaged the players the next time, and how I'm going to make sure the session doesn't suck, for lack of a better term. So I think the burden of the campaign management is on the DM. It's kind of the DM's responsibility to, you know, ensure the players are having a good time, which I know there's some folks who disagree with that.
Pain.
So, but I will say, you know, in that article, I included a poll at the bottom, just a simple poll that said, you know, I had just a statement. Is the DM's role primarily an entertainer for the players? And I just had strongly agree, disagree, and strongly disagree. And just a note, if you want to get more meaningful feedback, don't include a neutral category.
Right. That's a good tip.
Call that a forced choice. They have to either say agree or disagree, but it's a little sidebar.
Sure.
But so far I've gotten about 65 responses. And so far, there's only been 7 that have either said disagree, and there's only 1 that said strongly disagree. So the majority of people by far agree that the DM's DM's role is primarily to entertain players.
Sure.
Which I find somewhat surprising. Maybe there's a lot of players who read the blog and they want their DMs to entertain them.
I mean, I don't know. I've always felt that way. I think that the hard bit comes in defining entertainment, which is something we'll talk a little bit more about.
Yes.
What people say versus what they do or how they really feel.
Right. And it's each player is entertained in a little different way. And, you know, another part of that is, you know, DM is there to entertain. I had talked about, I think I'm very resistant to having the players die, which, you know, I want to be fair, but at the same time, you know, if a player's invested a year and a half in a character, if they have a few bad roles, should that lead to them dying, or should I create a situation where it's really unwinnable?
Right.
just to see, well, are they going to retreat or what's going to happen here?
Right, right.
So I think the DM's big challenge is to, you know what's entertaining to the players, kind of get a read on that, but also to learn how to craft appropriate challenges for the party, both in and out of combat.
Right.
So you're the arbiter of rules. You're, you know, responsible for creating those fair challenges. Meanwhile, the players just show up and kill things, which I kind of joke about. But,
right.
You know, some other players, some commenters on the blog post had mentioned, well, my players are always providing feedback to me and they're helping with along with my entertainment, mm-hmm. which that's great if that happens. And it's not and I prefaced it in the blog that I'm not trying to, you know, bang on players. I'm a player myself and I know how much time I spend on the campaign where I DM, and I know how much time I spend on the campaign when I'm a player. And more or less, it's like every two weeks, I show up as my player and I play for a few hours.
Right.
And then I don't think about it for 2 weeks.
Right. Yeah. There's a couple of interesting points with that. And, you know, I think there are probably some players who feel like they have the iron fist of, you know, I don't know that there's really that many DMs who are really out to kill like their party. Cause I don't imagine they have groups for very long when that happens.
Right. Exactly.
I think there are some who are just, you know, the absolute even hands of justice where, you know, if you are wiped out, you are wiped out and it's not my fault. You guys should have not poked that beholder in the eye. And, you know, and then there's, you know, guys like me, I feel that the DM's job is to entertain, but I think that entertainment comes in different forms. And for me, you know, I know my group is happiest when they get out of a situation that was really hard to get out of, but they did get out of it.
Right.
And, but you know, but that's not always true. You don't want every battle like that. And then now they're, you know, now it's a slog, like, oh God, you know, another one where I'm in lava in the beginning.
Right. And so it's great to come up with a balance of
right.
some easy battles and
exactly.
some where
yeah.
they really have
right.
to pull
battles where they
out
really
the
explode and get to show off everything that they've ever wanted to do. And then other ones where it's a real challenge and
right.
you know, that's, it's a difficult thing. But then there's another factor that I've thought about, cause I've run some games where my group was real happy with it and I was not. And, you know, I'm happy that they're happy, but I also felt like I didn't, like I was out of control. Not like in control, like the whole game is in control, but out of control, like I couldn't even control the things that I had put in there. Like
mm-hmm.
the whole thing. And, you know, this is always, there's been lots of conversation about like dazing and stunning and all the detrimental effects that players can put on monsters.
Right.
But I often, you know, when I get mad and I'm talking to my wife on our walks, she's one of my regular players. And, you know, I'll say like, if I had done the things to you that you did to my monsters, we wouldn't have a game, you know, like
right.
if you guys stun locked one of you guys for four rounds until you were dead, you'd stop playing. But I get stun locked for four rounds, or my dudes, my poor Orcus, you know, get stunned down to get stun locked for four rounds. So I think that the DM's enjoyment factors in as well. And I think we get a lot of our enjoyment from running a good game and having people that are happy, but sometimes we just want to see some stuff work. Not kill them all, you know, not wipe them out, but just see it work at least. You know, if you've got a monster and the monster's got a shtick, you want to see the shtick. You know, a beholder should be acting like, you know, should be fun to run a beholder, not like, hey, wow, every time I hit someone with an eye ray, they heal for more damage than I did.
Right.
You know, that the fun gets sucked out of it pretty quickly.
And I don't know if, and you'd be a great person to ask, you know, I tend to, if I have a monster that I'm really excited to use and it has an encounter power and it just totally misses with it or hasn't had a chance to use it, you know, I'll come up with another way for it to be able to use it during that encounter. Just it recharges when the monster gets bloodied, or
yeah,
you know, just to fudge things a little bit, not to be unfair, but also mm-hmm. to keep my enjoyment level
mm-hmm.
up, which, you know, I try to balance that out. I don't want to always be doing those things because then it's really, you know, taking away some of the player's choices.
Sure.
But, you know, if I have some monster that kind of set up terrain to be used in conjunction with the monster, but they lock the monster down too far away from the terrain to mm-hmm. really be effective.
Right.
I've given the monster will, you know, when it gets bloody, like, oh, it triggered its ability to teleport 6 squares and now it's over here.
Sure. Yeah.
The players have no idea that I just made that up.
Right.
But it helps my enjoyment because the second part of the fight, it'll be a little bit more interesting from my end.
Yeah. Your joy comes from seeing that, you know, you've sat and spent the time and energy making an encounter to work a certain way, you know, and you're not railroading the players into it, but you still want to say, like, look, you know, I mean, I see that with traps a lot. I'll have traps that I put in there and no one ever goes near the trap. They don't even do. I had the other one the other day with these great traps that I had written up and nobody ever went near them. So they never even saw them. And then I'm like, how am I going to award experience for that? You didn't even know it was there. How do you get, you know, but yeah. I, with the encounter powers and stuff like that, I tend to just make them reliable. And then they get it. If they miss it, they get it again. I wish that were part of the core, but it's not, you know, we kind of have to make that up.
And it relates to, you know, the level of responsibility that's on a DM to manage the game. Mm-hmm. The players don't have to worry about, well, I hope the DM really enjoys playing these monsters tonight. I hope he or she can, you know, use the best powers and really challenge us. I mean, they just want to survive and get through and move on to the next step of the quest.
Right.
So it's just a different level of responsibility that the DM has. And at least the way I look at it as I'm evaluating what's going on at the table with each player. I want each player to be able to shine both in and out of combat, focus on their backstories, and then allow them to use, you know, do their shtick, as you said, mm-hmm. in combat. So I'm kind of weighing that against making sure they're appropriately challenged.
Right, right. You wrote another article back in May 27th of this year called "I'm a Bad DM, Now What?" And in it, you kind of talk about career counseling and, you know, you have the good connection to the above average driver, that we're all above average drivers, and even when we're ramming our cars underneath school buses. And in it, you talk about the I don't know, is it pronounced as a word or is it simply given as its abbreviation, the RIASEC test?
RIASEC.
The RIASEC test. Okay. Yeah. Excellent.
It's a career counseling test. It's actually called the Strong Interest Inventory.
Yeah.
And that's the gentleman's name was Strong. And the theory it's based on are what called Holland codes. And if you want to know the backstory about those two ideas, if the links are on my blog in the mm-hmm. article. Mm-hmm. But there are 6 Holland codes. And the idea behind this theory is that, you know, you can describe people and describe work environments. So it was a way to match people's interest with the appropriate job. Mm-hmm. And the 6 Holland codes are realistic, investigative, artistic, social, enterprising, and conventional. And if you take the first letter of each word, it spells out the nifty acronym RIASEC. Mm-hmm. So real quickly, just going through them, realistic jobs are very practical and physical, hands-on. This would be things like farmer or police officer or firefighter, something that's very physically related. Investigative is more analytical, intellectual, scientific, explorative, something like a researcher, something like that. Artistic and social are pretty self-explanatory. So artistic jobs are creative, independent, not really a lot of structure. Social jobs are obviously cooperative, supporting, helping. As a psychologist, that would probably fall in the social category. Mm-hmm. Enterprising is more kind of being competitive, being a leader, persuading others. This would be like a sales job. Mm-hmm. And conventional is more detail-oriented, organizing, clerical work, things of that nature.
Are these based on like test scoring, or are they based on the you know, the testees? No.
That's not right. Subject's responses.
Subject, yeah, that's the word.
Participants, yes. Yeah. Well, the interesting thing about the Strong Interest Inventory, and there's a lot of fancy statistics behind it, but in general, they developed a test and they would give it to groups of workers that shared the same job. So they would give it to 100 doctors, 100 nurses, 100, you know, garbage collectors, 100, you know, many of these different jobs they would give the same test to. And then they would look at the average for those jobs, and you kind of come up with a profile for those jobs of, you know, what are the traits of these work environments. And then when a person takes the test, you look at their results and you can, with some, you know, validity, say, okay, well, your results match these people's results. So, for example, when I took the test back in graduate school, it said that I should be a speech pathologist, which doesn't exactly mean I should be a speech pathologist, but it's a social position. It's a position where it seems to be more on the helping and nurturing end of things, with some creativity also mixed in there and some research. So it's not an exact template of, okay, I'm going to take this test and then I'm going to know exactly what I should do with the rest of my life. But it's a good test if you're trying to figure out, well, what do I want to do? And it can point you in some good directions. So I started out with that idea of, well, if you're a bad DM, what do you do? You know, obviously there's a lot of great advice out there on online, you know, your blog and a lot of other blogs out there.
Some books.
Oh yeah, absolutely. When I first started DMing again, I bought the Dungeon Masters for Dummies book and read through that, and it was actually quite helpful. And when I wrote this, I was thinking about, well, how could I use this idea of career counseling to help, you know, DMs who are struggling with things? And the short hypothesis of the post was that, you know, the players probably fall into one of those six categories in terms of their interest, the reassect, either realistic, artistic, so on and so forth. And the DM probably has a style that they gravitate towards. And one of the issues with a game going wrong might be a clash of styles. That if the DM's very artistic and, you know, really doesn't care too much about certain factors of the game that the players are caring about, then that could be a bad match. And just kind of riffed off that idea and talked about, you know, specific things that DMs and players could be aware of.
Interesting. So let's talk about the Penny Arcade analysis that you did. I think this is the first series that had really... The original assessment that had grabbed my attention, because, you know, in the blogosphere, we all tend to, or I find a lot of blogs end up talking a lot about the same stuff. We all have opinions about the same stuff, and, you know, different bloggers have different takes on it. But if there's a controversy, or, you know, there's a new post, or there's a new product, you'll see a lot of series of posts that talk about it. They all tend to, you know, surround the topic. But the Penny Arcade analysis that you did showed a level of, you know, the level of analysis that I don't typically see in any of the blog articles. Like, you actually spent real time and real work on this. You know, you didn't just sit down on a Saturday morning like I do and, you know, poop something out that's going to get posted in the following Monday. You actually did a real analysis. So do you want to talk about what gave you that idea to do the analysis of the Penny Arcade podcasts?
Certainly, I'd love to, and I did spend quite a bit of time on it, to the dismay of my wife.
How long did it take you? Can I ask that?
Oh, boy. Well, with the first study, which I'll describe, I partially had to spend quite a bit of time figuring out how to code it. And it really started as me listening to the podcast on iTunes and listening to about 10 seconds of it, pausing, like writing things down or putting things into an Excel spreadsheet. And then playing it again, doing the same thing just over and over again. So it took, I don't know how many hours, but it took several days to get a good system to actually code the data. And then it took a few more days to analyze it and put it into some type of chart or table that was meaningful. Because the original spreadsheet, which I actually have not looked at for many months, probably because I spent so much time on it, I was like, yeah, I'm done with that. you know, if I just said, okay, here's a bunch of results, no one would have paid attention to it, because it wouldn't have made any sense. So I had to figure out a way to explain what I did and why I did it. And that's where I think my background as a psychologist came into play because I've written research papers before. I've had, you know, publications and scientific journals previously mm-hmm. about research that I've done.
Yeah, I mean this clearly reads like a scholarly article. You know, this is very atypical to the kind of articles that we see.
Well, and I just use the scientific method, like the way you would, like you have an introduction, you have a right. method, or in this case, okay, here's what I did, here's yeah. the idea, here's yeah. how I, you know, followed through on the idea, here are the results, here's what the results mean, and here's some conclusions and some questions for, right. you know, taking things forward.
Right.
And this topic was really the driving force behind the creation of my blog.
Mm-hmm.
I was, you know, reading through blogs like, you know, your blog, Slack Flourish, Sarah Dark Magic, and a lot of other things out there, and
right.
really benefiting immensely from all the advice and information that you guys were putting out there. But I've always had a bug to write, and I had never, you know, started a blog before or any type of website.
Mm-hmm.
And the discussion of combat speed, which came up and has been, you know, an issue for quite some time in the community, it really just piqued my interest because mm-hmm. as a player, you know, I want things to move faster so I can get to my next turn.
Right.
Especially if I miss.
Yeah, right.
So you wait 20 minutes and you miss, and it's like, well, damn, now I have to wait another 10, 15 minutes or longer for my turn again. And that sucks.
Right.
And as a DM, I'm aware of how much it sucks to be a player waiting for things to happen.
Right.
So I'm just very motivated to try to speed up combat and not be, you know, really harsh about it and have an egg timer out and, mm-hmm. you know, have a countdown clock. But
right. Nerf just gun. To, yeah.
Yeah. But just to realize that, well, why is this happening? Why is combat taking so long? And really, is it taking long? Because a lot of people were...
Mm-hmm.
complaining about combat speed, but the one thing that I never saw in any type of the commentaries and, you know, the series of articles you were talking about was any type of hard data.
Right. It was all just opinion, right? Or not even
right.
opinion, but it was kind of just like our own, what is it called? You know, our own
anecdotal.
Yeah, exactly. It's long.
Yeah.
It's really long. People take too long.
Yeah. So what I wanted to do is I want to say, well, okay, you know, well, let me see how long it is. At least I can provide some numbers to it. So my first idea was to actually record one of our gaming sessions in my home game. And then I realized that would be a mess because, one, I didn't have the equipment. Two, if I told players I was recording them, things
yeah,
would move
change,
a lot different.
Right.
Yeah, things would change. So that's when I thought about, I was like, well, I've listened to the Penny Arcade podcast. I have them, you know, saved on my iPod and my computer.
Right.
And a lot of people in the community know about them and can actually go listen to them if they're curious about the results. So when I made that connection, I just decided, okay, I need to find a way to code these things. And that was, once I had that idea, I was like, well, I'm going to start a blog and write about it. And that was really my first article.
Mm-hmm. That's great. So what were some of your big findings? What were some of the things that surprised you? There was one thing that surprised me, but I want to see, you know, from your perspective, you know, what surprised you from the analysis that you did?
Certainly. Well, the first thing I had to do was just find a way to turn those sessions, that encounter, it's a level 3 encounter that the players are going through, into something that was meaningful data. And what I did is I coded each player's turn, including the DM, into two categories. The first was time spent either role-playing or making tactical decisions. You know, which move should I do? Which power should I use? And the second category each turn was coded into was rolling dice and calculating damage or, you know, calculating skill checks, things of that nature. And the data demonstrated that most of the time was spent in the first category. Most of it was spent role-playing and, you know, weighing tactical decisions.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of surprises, I was interested that there was a wide range of time spent taking turns among the players.
Mm-hmm.
So you might think, well, every player took about the same time, but in the 5 rounds of combat, one of the players only took 3 minutes,
mm-hmm.
While another took 4 times, like took 12 minutes to complete their turns
Will
over
Wheaton.
The 5 rounds. So, you know, you might have those players at your table where somebody is like real quick, they're
right.
like boom, 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 I'm done. and another player who's shuffling their character sheet and moving cards around, or, you know, if they have an iPad, they're looking, you know, they're scrolling up and down, mm-hmm. and it's like, come on already, go.
Right, right.
And, you know, that was a little bit of a surprise just how wide the disparity was just in a five round encounter. One player took 3 minutes, another player took 12.
Sure.
But I explained in the post that in the podcast, the player who took the longest is, you know, the immortal Will Wheaton.
Right.
And it's obvious that he's new to fourth edition. He's right. learning the rules. So he's asking a lot of questions in terms of what he can do and how he can do it.
Right.
So in terms of that, it's very understandable why he's taking longer. And one of my conclusions from doing the coding is just to make sure everyone knows the system and knows their powers, mm-hmm. which seems like simple advice, but I still see it at the tables I play at to this day. People aren't quite sure right. what powers they have or how they interact.
Right, right.
So yeah. that was somewhat surprising.
I'm going to talk about that more.
And just real quick, the other thing was just how fast the DM moved.
Yeah.
It really kind of shamed me.
Well, it's Chris Perkins.
I know.
He shames us all.
And I feel like that's such a stereotype to be like, oh, Chris Perkins is awesome, but now I have data.
Right. I have empirical evidence
that shows that, yes, he is a rock star.
He'll be good. He'll be happy to know that.
So
math proves you are awesome.
Exactly. Exactly. Because with, you know, it is a rather straightforward encounter. All the monsters appear at once. He's running seven monsters in this encounter, which I believe is a level 5 as it's written online in DDI, mm-hmm. which you can go, you know, look up the encounters and kind of read along as they're being played on in the podcast.
Right.
But his turns take just over like a minute and a half each round.
Yeah.
And actually most of them are like under 90 seconds.
Right.
And it was just a surprise because I was thinking about my own turns as a DM and that they at least feel like they're taking quite a bit longer. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I like, which I've tried to do in my game, is he takes all the monsters' turns at once mm-hmm. instead of, you know, mob A is first in initiative, then it's two players, then it's mob B. Mm-hmm. You know, he just has all the monsters go at once, so the initiative order is never affected. You know, the players know, okay, well, the DM went, so now it's my turn. And after that person's turn, it's my turn. Hmm. When you have different mobs get into the equation throughout initiative, when one of them dies, they're removed from initiative, but the players might not realize it, so they're actually waiting for something to happen.
Right.
So that's one, you know, useful tip I came out of that with.
Right.
But I don't know what he's doing. I don't even hear dice rolling.
Hmm.
When he's playing, I don't know if he's using an online dice roller.
He's so good, or he has the dice all in his head. He could just think a random number.
If he's using the force or something, I'm not quite sure. But so that was another surprising thing. Like I couldn't even code his turns into those two categories
because he couldn't tell when he was rolling.
Yeah, because they were so fast.
Yeah,
it was like this monster moves here and hits you, and you take 8 damage, yeah. and now it's your turn. I was like, well, damn, how'd that happen?
One of the things you calculate in here is the amount of time per round overall. And the thing that immediately grabbed my attention in the article is that there's significantly more time spent in the first two rounds than in the following three. You know, it's not quite at the case where, you know, round one and two, well, it is true. Round one and two take up more time than round 3, 4, and 5 all put together in this one, if my math is right. I think it's right. And that's an interesting, you know, that was an interesting conclusion for me that a lot of the time up front is taking place in round one and two. The battle's just starting to find its way. There's a lot of discussion. I'm assuming, like, maybe watch as I come up with my own reasoning for why that's true. Why was that true? Do you know why that's true?
I was just going to ask you, what do you think might be causing that?
What I would think is causing it is when you first lay out a battle, there's a lot of questions about where things are and who's where. You have all of your critters and all of your players are on the mat at the same time. You know, they're all on the encounter at the same time. So you have a lot of, you know, as you put it, mobs, you know, mobile objects that are all running around. So you have to pay attention to all of those. The players have their full range, often will have their full range of capability. They certainly have all their encounter powers. They haven't blown anything yet. And so that's what I would assume, that, you know, it's all that situational starting to find it. But then I'd also guess that there's another aspect, which is they are more interested, so they're taking more time, and they're less interested in the later rounds, so their rounds tend to get quicker. But I would just be guessing.
Yeah, no, I think you're right on with those ideas. I think the first round, like you said, everyone has their powers. They're getting the lay of the land, so to speak. Okay, the monsters are over here. There seems to be a threat over in that direction. Okay, who should we go after first? And there's a lot of just setting the stage for the combat. And then as the monsters disappear, as the players kill them, there's less threats to focus on, so the decisions are a lot faster. One thing I thought after doing the first study was, well, the first round's always going to take the longest, that because of the reasons we just talked about. Mm-hmm. And I actually found when I did the next encounter in the podcast series that wasn't the case, that the first round did take quite a long time, but I think it was the third or fourth round that actually took the longest. And that's because, you know, the DM introduces a couple of new threats in the form of a lurker and a trap that was inactive but then springs to life. Mm-hmm. So then the players are about three rounds in, they think they have the encounter under control, and then it's like, holy geez, we got something else is going on. We got a player trapped. There's this lurker around who's now attacking us.
Right.
And they have to reevaluate things. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that reevaluation just takes a lot of time. Mm-hmm. And found that it was actually that round that was the longest, as the players are still scrambling a little bit and right. trying to figure out how they're going to survive the encounter.
Right. The immortal Chris Perkins actually wrote an interesting, an interesting way to kind of deal with that situation in his three act. The name of the article is Riot Acts. It's where he talks about running epic games and how to break out encounters into a three act structure, something that the newbie DM has also talked about before. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing there is you can kind of take away some of that initial setup time by only putting part of the challenge out in the beginning. So things look pretty simple. Maybe the first round is all minions. You know, it's just six minions come out, and they, you know, they're known to be minions, so there's not a lot of monkeying around trying to figure out what they are. And they might wipe out the minions, but that alerts, you know, in round two comes the two big, you know, the two bigger guys, and in round three comes the big boss. And that way, that curve of high time in the beginning that slowly goes down, you know, kind of gets more evened out by keeping things as simple as you can in round one, and then adding the complexity as the rounds go forward.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. I think there's a lot of ways that you can experiment with the encounter design of, you know, do you try to just really slam the players all at once? Do you kind of slowly trickle things out like you were just talking about, or, you know, wind the battle down, and then at the very end something new comes out and pretty much
right.
just starts a whole new thing. So
right.
I think if you go to any one technique all the time, it's going to get stale.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's my thoughts, at least.
Sure.
It helps to shift things up, because if you're always just slowly introducing threats, then the players are going to learn, okay, let's hold off on our big attacks because this is just
one. Boss always comes out in round three.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, let's save up the dailies for, you know, two rounds from now. You know, that I don't know about your games, but I certainly have plenty of metagaming going on at the table.
The other interesting thing, this is something Dave Chalker and I have talked on this podcast before about the out, and you know, the way to build an encounter around a closing, you know, around a goal, and that goal can end a battle early, so you don't have the constant, oh, we got to kill every single guy that shows up. Mm-hmm. And that also alters that curve, because you might have round one, two, and three, but you don't have a round four and five, because the end of round three was the actual, you know, completion of whatever that goal was, one way or the other.
Right.
You know, so those are all different tools that a DM can use. You know, you can use the three act structure for larger combats where you want to even that curve out. You can use the out if you really only want three rounds. What I found in my higher level games, that the rounds would get so long. We'll talk about paradox of choice in a minute, but that the rounds get so long that they tend not to go longer than three. I've rarely had, even Orcus, I think, was a 3-round fight.
Wow.
And it's because, you know, it's going to go bad one way or the other really fast. And those rounds, there's a lot that happens in those rounds. You know, players get probably twice as many actions in a round at Epic than they do in earlier ones. So it feels like a 6-round fight, even if it's only been three. And they're like, wow, you know, I think I only activated twice.
So yeah, we just had, even in, we're in about mid Paragon level in the game I'm a player in. And mm-hmm. we had a situation where there's this Golem that was attacking us. We had a fighter who had marked it, and we had a bard doing something. And there was one power that triggered this 6 or 7 stage combo between yep. four players and the monster reacting, and then
right.
another minion reacting. It
right.
was,
feels like a whole extra game going on.
It was crazy, and it kept happening because it was, okay, you attack, you hit this monster. Now this guy gets 2 attacks,
right.
which sparks the fighter to attack again, and like, you at times forgot whose turn it was.
Yep, yep.
You know, but one of the things I looked at in those podcasts was to try to figure out what an average turn length is. And what I found, at least for that group, which I would say is pretty experienced and obviously has a very skilled DM, is that most turns are taking a minute or 2 minutes or longer.
Mm-hmm.
There was only 3% of the turns that actually took under 60 seconds.
Really?
Yeah,
huh.
which I think gives DMs a good tool to estimate how long combat sessions are going to take or
yeah.
combat encounters are going to take.
Yeah,
if you have 6 players and your combats typically go about 5 rounds, then just do the math. You know, 6 times 2 times, you know, however many rounds you think you're going to have,
right.
and there's an estimate for how long you can space out for that encounter.
Right. Right.
It's not a perfect estimate, but it gives you an idea.
Right, right.
It's the only data I've seen out there.
Sure. No, it's a great series. I look forward to you doing like maybe a monthly series like this. I think that would be wonderful.
I need to hire some coders.
Yeah, I don't have any money to give you to do it.
Yeah, but. Well, I spent most of my recent time on the another analysis on player powers, and that's
yeah, and let's talk about that, because there's a couple interesting things here that I'd like to talk about on power. And I believe the name of the article is Power Options, Status Effects, and Mutual Assured Destruction.
Yes.
Yeah, it's another great article. So can you talk a little bit about this analysis? What was your, you know, what was the motivation to do it, and how'd you go about gathering the data, and what did the data tell you?
Certainly. Well, again, this springs out from just paying attention to what's being talked about in the online community. You know, certainly you, and with your focus on epic tier play mm-hmm. and trying to come up with new ways to speed up those games, to make them a little bit more meaningful for players, to challenge players. You know, that's been something that I've just been interested in. And again, it was one of those things of there's a lot of commentary about it.
Yeah.
But why is it happening?
Right.
You know, what are the reasons behind it?
Right.
And when in doubt, I try to figure out a way to look at data
mm-hmm.
to figure those things out. So, you know, one of the main points that you've talked about, and you talked about maybe like 20 minutes ago, was, you know, having monsters stun locked and mm-hmm. having players just completely roll through difficult encounters or encounters that you think are going to be difficult, and then your monsters are dead in 2 or 3 rounds, and you're thinking, what just happened? Like, mm-hmm. I spent weeks designing this, and now, you know, where's my fun? So what I wanted to do was come up with a way to code just how powers do scale over time. And what I decided to do, my initial thought was to code every power for every type of class in the game. And I started with a controller and bard, because that's the first one listed in Character Builder.
Mm-hmm.
And after several days of not being finished coding the powers, I realized, well, coding all of them,
wow,
you know, this is a hot topic now, and by the time I finish this, maybe
no one will care.
In April, the 5th edition will be out, and no one will care about yeah. this little study. So I just decided to do one class from each role, just to see if the roles were different in terms of what status effects they apply, and how those status effects might change over tiers.
Right.
So the purpose was to study three main assumptions, which I want to make sure I get those assumptions correct in the way I word them. I'm just looking that up now. The assumptions in Epic here that combat includes too many moving parts, and the parts move more dramatically as the players advance in level. Players gain more options in combat as they advance in level, and the players gain more powerful options in combat as they advance in level. And the data did support that. What I looked at is I coded each power, each at will, each encounter power, and each daily power. I ignored the Paragon Paths and Epic Destinies just because there were too many options.
Right.
So if anything, the results I have are under-reporting just how many toys the players have to use.
You also, obviously, items. You didn't include items either, right?
Of course, yeah. I don't know how many thousand items there are right now in the game.
A lot. I think it was like 9,000 or something.
And one of the interesting things I found out almost immediately is even with the at-wills, you know, even though the at-will doesn't have a status effect, there's something else it does. So it's not like, okay, you hit the monster and it's 1d6 plus 8 damage. It's, you know, 1d6 plus 8 damage and you slide one square and the monster takes negative 2 to AC.
Right.
And it was just amazing how many powers had other effects that you wouldn't consider status effects, but all these other benefits and penalties to the monsters. Mm. So I think I'd have to go back and look the exact numbers, but the percentage of player powers that were just strictly damage, I think it was less than 5% by far. So what happens, I think, by Epic tier is you have every power does two or three or four things.
Right.
And it creates not only with that one player, but there's this synergistic effect between players where, okay, I'm going to slide this monster over here. That gives you combat advantage. You hit them. Okay, now we all have higher AC, and this person's taking ongoing 15 damage. There's just so many other benefits that the players have from using powers, including, you know, some of the things I coded were ongoing damage, force movement, so either sliding an ally or pushing an enemy, a lot of defense bonuses for the party, defense penalties for the enemies, powers that let you heal, things that grant combat advantage. So it took a little while to come up with a graph that actually, or a table that made sense of that data, but I was pretty happy with the end result, and it's fancy and colorful. So.
Yeah, no, it's great. I mean, it's you know, it's another just really, really deep and in-depth thing. Got me thinking about it a lot, and I've been thinking about it a lot. It's been an unhealthy amount of time thinking about this, you know, these kinds of issues. And so it was really interesting to see a breakdown like this. There was a quote in a recent Rule of Three article that says, by the time characters reach mid Paragon tier, they're closer to 15 powers than the seven we want than the seven or so we'd want, and that doesn't even include magic items. Some players eagerly chase items that offer more power selections, while other players avoid them like the plague and stick to items with simple properties. Epic characters are probably 3 to 4 times more complex than the goal we'd originally set, at least in terms of the number of powers at their disposal. You know, in this same article, Rich Baker talks about I think the name of the book is The Paradox of Choice. Is that right, or do I have it? Is it a different one?
No, that sounds correct.
Yeah, there's a, you know, idea like 5 to 7 choices are your best number of choices. Yeah, The Paradox of Choice by Barry Schwartz is the name of the book, and you can kind of see it pretty clearly when you look at D&D. And I know, when I transitioned from 3.5 to 4, I loved it because I looked and I said, wow, look, it's got this refined set of powers per character. And you know, I know from web development and stuff like that, that when you have 5 to 7 options for things, that people, it's a lot easier for people to use it. You know, as soon as menus get to be more than 7 options, then they start to get lost. And, you know, as a real gross kind of look at it. And I also like that as characters gotten higher levels, they had to substitute powers rather than just constantly gain new ones. But then that starts to break down. Utility powers never go away. You can have many utility powers. Item powers, you know, as you grow and grow. Particularly if you start at level one and go all the way up, you're going to be just loaded with magic items because you never get rid of anything. There's never any point. The self are so low that you might as well just keep it. Mm-hmm. And then when you throw on Paragon Paths and Epic Destinies on top of that, then what you have is you go from, you know, the seven that they want to, as he says, you know, 3 to 4 times that, you know, 28 potential powers. And then the other thing that I throw on top of that is also more actions per turn. You know, what I see from high level characters is that they have the action economy starts to break down. They get a lot more options. They, you know, in the Paragon path, you start to see a lot of minor action attacks. You start to see a lot of reactionary either interrupts or reactions that they can use. But then in Epic, you start to see a lot of free action stuff. So-and-so lets somebody else attack. Some condition is met and now everybody gets a free attack. You know, there's now, it just grows and grows so that not only do they have these, you know, 28, and I'm just making a number up, but 28 potential options every time something happens. But now they also have more times when they have to make those choices. Do you have any thoughts about how choice factors into Epic tier? Well, not just Epic tier, but, you know, factors in as D&D goes up in level and how that can affect rounds? You know, this kind of ties to this the article in here on power options, but also back to the analysis that you did with on the Penny Arcade podcast.
Certainly. And you talk about those, you know, more than 5 to 7 choices, and it's not a mistake that they talk about your short-term memory or your working memory mm-hmm. is 5 to 7 chunks big.
Right.
And that's why phone numbers are 7 digits. I mean, mm-hmm. now we don't have to remember phone numbers because we put them in our cell phones and
yeah, just right.
tap a few buttons and you don't need to remember it.
Right.
But there was a very purposeful reason why they only had phone numbers that were 7 digits long. Because anything beyond that,
no one could remember. Mind
just has more trouble remembering it. But yeah, I think you're right on. Again, the more, and I think I used the example in one of the analysis articles I posted of, you talked about a menu of, you know, if you're asking a friend or your spouse where you want to go to eat. Mm-hmm. If you say, you know, do you want to go to eat to McDonald's or do you want to go to Olive Garden? Like, that's a pretty clear choice.
Right.
You know what you're going to get there. I think what happens by Epic is you got about five fast food restaurants, a couple of mid-scale places to eat, a couple of like upper tier places to eat. They're all in different locations and it's a different experience. So you have to take longer to make a decision. If you only can say yes or no, that's easier than saying, well, like kind of maybe agree or kind of maybe don't agree. It just takes longer to execute, execute a decision.
Right.
And I think, you know, even by that time in a campaign, you're very familiar with your player and what powers you have and how they work. But there's so many combinations of, and I'm even seeing this in Paragon, where something happens and a player's like, oh, wait, when you're missed by an attack, you get to do this, I think. Hold on, let me check.
Right.
And it, you know, all these choices just create things to grind to a halt.
Sure.
If the players only had 3 decisions to make, that's going to take a shorter amount of time than if they have 7 decisions to make, or like you're saying, like 15 or more.
Mm-hmm.
And then the powers that they do have, something else that I found is they are indeed more powerful. So, you know, there's in my analysis for the leader, controller, defender, and striker I selected, in heroic, there were no powers that granted the stunned mm-hmm. status effect.
Mm-hmm.
Between those 4 roles, there's 9 powers in Paragon, but by Epic, there's just within Epic are 16 powers. So by the time the party gets to Epic tier, there's 25 different options for them to be able to stun monsters.
Mm-hmm.
There's another 13 or so to weaken monsters, and 3 that can actually just remove the monster from the combat, you know, banish them to another realm for a turn.
Right.
So there's not only are the choices are longer, but also the damaging effects to the monsters are significantly more problematic mm-hmm. if you're trying to create a balanced encounter.
Mm-hmm. In this,
I don't know if that answers your question, though.
It does. Yeah. In this same rule of three article, Richard Baker talks about how the design of essentials went kind of back and relooked at that number of options. So you see a lot more, classes that have a single encounter power that they get to use multiple times per encounter as they get higher in level, but it's the same power. So they don't really have to choose. It's, you know, in some cases, like, you know, with a hunter, they get two options with that power. Do I want to slide them, or do I want to knock them prone, or something like that? Or do I daze them or knock them prone? I think I'm sure I'm getting that wrong.
And that would be an interesting comparison for someone, and maybe I'll find time to do it in the new year, to take four classes from the essentials line mm-hmm. and do the same type of analysis right. to see what differences there are.
Right, right. My wife corrected me. It's days and what?
Mobilize.
Days and immobilize for the hunters. She plays a hunter.
Okay.
So the interesting thing is when I saw the essentials guys, and when I got that idea, when I read it, I was like, ah, this is kind of getting back to that idea of offering a simple set of choices, not for all the classes, but for certainly a lot of them, mm-hmm. and returning back to that same, you know, level of complexity that they were looking for in the original 4E. And for me, that was the line in the sand. I was like, okay, you know, we know the rule set for fourth edition, but these new classes, in my opinion and in my mind, run much smoother at the table than older classes. But I found a lot of resistance, both with my players and in the D&D community, with everybody who would bother to listen to me. that they hated that idea. You know, they do not want to lose all of the options that they had. They don't want to lose all those things that they had available. And they said, no, the characters are boring and they don't do anything. And all I do is attack and attack and attack with my basic melee attack. And how boring is that? And, they wanted all of that complexity. They don't want to go down to, you know, 9 powers at level 30. They want the 27 that they had before. So it seems like there's a, you know, and maybe it's because they don't care that games go a lot longer. Maybe it's they don't care how that, you know, decision paralysis fits in. I certainly understand when they say, well, I did a lot more. But, you know, what I'm seeing from the Essentials characters is they're not underpowered. They are very powerful. Because slayers and thieves do more damage consistently than I've seen from any class. Mm-hmm. But they're much simpler, which means in my mind that the game goes much smoother if I had a lot of Essentials. You know, essentials characters, and but do you, you know, can you explain? Is there something behind the idea that even though the choices are better or more clear, and that maybe I'm making an assumption, you know, maybe I'm jumping ahead, that you know, to me, the design of an essentials character is clearly a more advantageous for the overall fun of the game. Yet players are resistant and reluctant to move to an essentials only game because they like having all of those options.
It brings a few things to mind, and I hope I remember to talk about all of them right now. I think first and foremost, if you give players, or really if you give anybody a bunch of toys to play with, and then you decide later to take them away, mm-hmm. there's going to be some claims to be like, well, hey, I want this toy. Like, mm-hmm. why? I like playing with this. I don't want to play with this other toy, mm-hmm. even if that other one might be a little different or in some ways better. Mm-hmm. Especially if players have been playing a certain style now for, fourth edition's been out for 4 years?
Yeah, about 4 years.
Okay. And Essentials is about a year and a half, two years old. I've played in games where we've had mixed. Some players are, you know, the original standard classes, and other players are essentials. And it is a little jarring mm-hmm. to mix them, because the essentials characters, and really, they don't seem to have as much stuff going mm-hmm. on. Mm-hmm. I mean, they do cool things, but it's just different than, it runs a little bit differently than the other characters, at least in my experience.
Right.
So I think that's part of it. Players have just become accustomed to, well, this is the way we play the game. And mm-hmm. if you change the game, I'm not happy with that.
Right.
And I think that relates somewhat to what we were originally talking about in terms of it's the DM's role to entertain. I think a lot of the hand-wringing about rule changes and combat length and all these other changes to the game are from DMs and not really from players.
Yeah, yeah, I think you're right.
Because the players just show up and play their character and mm-hmm. kind of play with their toys for a few hours, and then they go home and don't think about it until the next session.
Yeah, but they're still the ones to clearly get tired and kind of looking up at the ceiling when a battle goes longer than 90 minutes, or, you know, when it's the whole game is running more than an hour over, or they're on their iPad because somebody's taking forever to figure out what they want to do. So right. I think it's that idea of kind of measuring behavior vice measuring what they're actually saying. You know, they're what they're saying is, I like all my stuff and I'm real happy with the game and I don't need it to change. But what their behavior is, wow, another mundane battle where we're whooping everyone's butt because we are totally overpowered. And the battles take forever anyway because nobody can figure out what they want to do.
Yeah, and I think that brings up a point that you had kind of referred to earlier about, you know, how do we figure out what players want, what they say they want and what they really want.
Right.
You know, what do they... They might say they're entertained by one thing, but their mm-hmm. behavior around the table says something else.
Right, right.
And I think, again, it kind of falls on the DM to ask the players directly, either ask them in person, send them an email. Mm-hmm. On my site, I have a new player interview to try to get a sense of a player's expectations mm-hmm. for the campaign. But to even send that to your existing players and be like, you know, I always tell my players I'm open to feedback. Please let me know what's working. Tell me what's not working. And I think the DM has to be open to feedback. You know, if you say, how can I fix the game? And a couple players tell you something. I mean, it's never easy to receive critical feedback.
Mm-hmm.
I think you have, if you're asking for that information, you have to be willing to accept it.
Right.
I realize that's not an easy thing to do.
Right.
And it's a lot to ask of your players as well. Especially if it's a group where it's a more casual game, maybe everyone's not the best of friends outside of the sessions, but, you know, you've just kind of met up through friends of friends.
Mm-hmm.
And to tell someone, like, hey, you're playing really slow. Like,
yeah.
You need to pick right. it up. You're right. kind of calling that person out, and that person might not enjoy that. So it's a delicate balance. Again, comes back to the DM and how you have relationships with your players
mm-hmm.
and how they have relationships with each other too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, this has been a great podcast. I learned a lot, and I believe that good dungeon mastering is an art form, and like all art forms are, you know, we could get all whimsical and talk all artsy fartsy, or we could also do pretty good analysis of what's going on. Like you said, looking at the group, the dynamics of the group, their behavior, their communication, looking at ourselves, how we feel, how, you know, areas that we think we can improve. I mean, obviously all this works just as well looking at your overall life as it does looking at being a dungeon master, as I'm sure you know. But I think it's very valuable. I mean, anybody that spends the kind of time that a lot of us DMs spend should also spend the time to try to make their game as good as they can make it. And this kind of analysis is, I think, really useful. And like I said, from the articles that we've been talking about, I've learned a lot. So I think the articles, you know, particularly the statistical analyses that you've done, they're the best. They're some of the best articles I've seen written about Dungeons and Dragons, written about 4th edition Dungeons and Dragons.
Oh, wow.
Clearly a lot of work, a lot of thought went into these. They're right up my alley. They're exactly the kind of article that I want to read. Thank you for that. I thank you for giving them away.
You're welcome. Thank you for that feedback. It's pretty amazing that, you know, I used to go online to look at your blog and other ones and really, you know, was just an observer
mm-hmm.
In terms of the D&D community. And, you know, not to get all gushy, but to get that feedback from you and actually be doing this podcast and having, you know, some of the people that work at Wizards
mm-hmm.
like retweet links to my articles,
yep.
it's pretty mind-blowing.
Right.
And I think it goes to say that if you're out there listening to this and you have some things to say that you think are noteworthy, you know, write them down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't be afraid to just kind of jump in and see what happens.
Yep.
I've been pleasantly surprised to see that, you know, one thing, I believe it was Randall Walker said that if you don't see the type of content that you want, create it.
Yep.
And right. since I didn't see, you know, data on some
right.
of these things,
yep.
I went
right.
out.
It's a lot of opinion. And
yeah.
God knows I propagate it. I'm all about opinion.
No, opinion is very
I feel a certain way and I want everybody to know it.
No, I've benefited, you know, so much from you and a lot of the other people who are very active on Twitter. And it's just been a great thing to really become a part of these last 9 months. I started back in March, late March.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's been kind of crazy because it's just a hobby for me. I'm just someone who plays games hopefully once a week, but sometimes it's every other week.
Mm-hmm.
And just I write in the blog. So I appreciate all the feedback I get. I try to respond to everyone who leaves a comment for mm-hmm. me on the articles.
Mm-hmm.
If you send me emails, I respond to those pretty quickly.
Yep.
So
yep. You've helped me quite a bit on a number of different projects. Kept me honest.
Kept you honest.
Yep. So no, it's been great. And I hope it is my great hope that you become completely independently wealthy and you can spend all of your time doing this kind of analysis on your site.
Yeah. If you find out a way for me to do that, you let me know, but
yeah.
I'm actually excited. I've never been to, you know, Gen Con. So that's my mm-hmm. big plan this year.
Oh, are you going to Gen Con this year?
I'm hoping to, yes.
Oh, excellent. Well, we'll have to
put in the vacation time.
We'll
for
definitely
it,
have
so
to
I'm,
meet up. Yeah.
I've
my
more
my wife and I always go.
More or less committed to it. I'm yep. going to go with my cousin who does the artwork for the Monster series on my site.
Oh, really?
Hoping to meet up with him.
Excellent.
Yes.
Excellent.
But that's another subject. But yeah, I'm excited to meet some of these people.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's always Gen Con. If you've never been, it's wonderful. I can't recommend it enough. It's like you died and went to nerd heaven. It's
excellent.
A whole different culture. It's wonderful. Well, thank
excellent.
You very much. This has really been great.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you. Appreciate the support.